This podcast is part of the Gonna Geek Network. The opinion expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gonna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GonnaGeek.com and get ready because geekiness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, the podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Whitten.
I prefer to jazzercise my demons, but yeah. And my co-host, Haley Malley.
That line you're worrying about crossing. Look behind you.
And Keir Hansen.
Gallifrey Public Radio. Now we have maths.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 96 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we are thrown roughly into a pivotal episode with no explanation or exposition, but quickly become fan favorites, inspiring multiple recurrences, petitions for spin-offs, and a plethora of potato-based jokes and puns. I'm not going to be the target of those potato puns. I'll take that. My name is Keir. Joining me in the GPR studios as every week is Jay. Good evening, sir.
Hello. How's it going?
Fantastic, as always. Another week clicked off, and we are not at SDCC, but that's okay because
neither is Doctor Who.
and across from us there, Haley is joining us in the studio as well. Good evening, Haley.
Good evening.
Reed, what's up tonight?
Well, this week we're discussing the Paternoster Gang, the collective identity for Silurian Madame Vostra, her human wife and business partner Jenny, and their resident warrior manservant carbohydrate, Suntaran Commander Strax. From their rather abrupt introduction in A Good Man Goes to War to their upcoming appearance in Deep Breath, we are taking a look at what makes the trio of pseudo-companions such fan favorites.
Do we want to put this under another one of those potentially divisive statements?
Well, yeah, you can kind of tell that from the... We put the question out there to our fans, to the listeners, about the... what do you think of the Paternoster Gang? And we got some responses, and it's kind of telling what we got. From at Northwest Raven 1, we got, the characters are interesting enough to spin off, and I'd watch a solo Rose with 10-2, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, obviously some support for the spinoff idea. And then from at Fainus, boring, stylish, and I love that Suntaran, but the gag gets old in a hurry, and then snores. So, I mean, just in the feedback that we got, it's already divisive.
Mm-hmm. As seems to be any character that really kind of gets introduced in post-2005 Who. You're always going to have people that latch on and say, oh, that's a great addition to the show. I kind of like what that does for it. It's a new dynamic. It's a whatever. It's a fresh, you know, insert adjective here. But then there's other people who say, you know, either it doesn't suit the story. It's not a necessary character direction. They're just a vehicle. Rah, 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 rah.
Well, and a lot of the issue comes from the fact that these guys were introduced in A Good Man Goes to War, you know, middle of series 6, and they're just thrown in. No explanation, nothing, just kind of like, hey, here you go, here's 3 more characters, moving on forward. And then we don't see them again until the Snowmen. So, you know, the big gap that we had between 6 and 7, and then the Christmas special there, and we're like, okay, what the heck?
So... Well, let's take that, because that's interesting. When you say that, you know, in A Good Man Goes to War, the fact that they were just sort of sprung on the viewing public, they do make an attempt, at least for Vostra and Strax, to give a little bit of a tether to previous events. You know, they're trying to make that connection for Vostra to what had happened in the previous episode where the Silurians were unearthed in London Underground and so forth. And she, one of her sisters, I guess, involved, or the deaths of her sisters. And that was an obvious connection specifically to the Doctor in terms of a respectful, not partnership, just kind of a respectful agreement between them of what their pursuits were.
But see, that never made sense to me either, though, because the, what was it, the Hungry Earth and... whatever that two-parter was, I can't remember the name of the other one. But that happened in the not-too-distant future, right? I mean, that was supposed to be within, like, a few years of present day. And so why is Vostra in Victorian London?
Maybe there was a smaller group of them in hibernation somewhere else.
Yeah, but it, like, I got the I got the sense that that was, they were trying to tie that together, but it's like, well, why is she paying a debt that happens 300 years in the future? Like it just, it never made sense to me. So that was always my biggest hang up on that, was like, well, there has to be another story here. Like she's got to be, you know, referring to something that we don't have any information on, and we never have gotten that. So I don't know. And then, you know, with Strax, obviously, you know, he's doing his penance being a nurse, and, you know, he keeps making reference to the fact that, you know, the doctor is basically punishing him for something he's done. And we don't get that backstory either. It's just kind of like, nope, you're just supposed to accept it at this point and move forward, which for some reason works with Strax. I don't know why. Like, yes, I would like to get the backstory, but he's a Santarin. He was in a battle, doctor said no, and that's it. Yeah, it never really was one of those things I'm like, I need to know what happened in order to understand this character. But for Vastra, it seems like she's such a dynamic character and so has such a depth to her that I want to know what it is that she was, you know, what the favor she was repaying or whatever it was.
Okay. I like the fact that, well, it's interesting to note because of everything that had been bandied about how this upcoming season was going to play out, or some of the topics that they were going to address, or some of the, you know, characters throughout history that they were going to potentially brush shoulders with. Remember that Vastra's introduction is after she's just defeated or potentially even devoured Jack the Ripper.
Right.
So the fact that some people were saying, oh, they're going to use a whole Jack the Ripper trope for the introduction of Capaldi's doctor. Well, technically, that could work if they, you know, suddenly bump him back to right around that time frame.
Wibbly wobbly timey wimey.
Yeah, could be an interesting little fold over there.
Very River Song is.
And Moffat really does like that telling people stories out of order thing.
Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah, because that's how he is able to kind of smooth out a lot of the wrinkles in where the stories don't quite mesh. He says, well, you know, loop those 2 days back and, you know, squint your eyes real tight and look at it slightly sideways over your left shoulder. But yeah, as far as, you know, where we end up with this thing, I mean, and Good Man Goes to War is probably one of my favorite, you know, post-2005, you know, or what was the name? We're not using the Z word. However the hell we're going to call it, the RTD and beyond.
Rebooted who?
who Mark II? as far as overall episodes go, you know, the score is intense. The story is just pretty interesting because you get the culmination of some threads that had been kind of looped out across all of Series 6 there. Mm-hmm. You know, and you get these kind of characters to play around with and everything too. Your Heavy River Song, she's in full tilt through the whole episode and so on. But you look at, we get just a little bit of backstory, or maybe backstory isn't the right word, as far as just kind of fleshing out these characters. And you could tell that they were ones that were going to be usable, not necessarily guaranteed for use, but usable. You know, they seemed like they put an awful lot into, at least with Vostra's case, you know, putting her out there just to say, all right, well, that was an interesting one-off character to use for the sake of getting through this one. Let's put her back in the box. Oh, by the way, the fat blue guy's dead. We'll worry about him later. You know, and just, you know, disperse everything. I think the only thing that they kind of left a bit hinky was Strax laying there supposedly dying. You know, and interesting to note that even with all the kind of the little comedic elements that they put in with his character, they give him that moment, you know, where he actually has a couple of lines discussing about, you know, this is a true death and those things, and that he didn't expect it to be quite as the way it was, you know, that he wasn't quite prepared for it, or you know, so forth. It actually becomes a balance in Strax that I wish they would get back, because I think they might have gone a little too over the edge with him.
A little slapsticky.
Or nothing but. But for people that have ever gotten the opportunity to see it, this kind of, you know, spins forward into some webisodes that they did to stitch us, you know, or keep the characters kind of recurrent as we head into Series 7. So we've got, and this is actually, it's potentially kind of really hard to find. BBC really didn't want this to be necessarily that distributable. It's not one of the officially sanctioned clips that they keep on YouTube on their BBC channel and things. But that's the Battle of Demons Run, 2 days later. Now, I'm assuming you guys have gotten a chance to watch this over a few times.
I didn't actually get a chance to watch them.
What? Yeah, no. This was just, basically, this was their chance to try and explain why Strax is actually there. You know, you Vastar and Jenny basically come back and revive him, bring him back from the dead, whatever the hell you want to call it, and basically, you know, say, hey, come help us out. We did this for you. Come with us.
Yeah. And it's kind of an interesting, you know, talk about the making the characters kind of poignant and all. They kind of break it down for him. I mean, yes, they have their kind of comedic moment where he's, oh, it's I'm done for. It's a warrior's death. I'm on the great battlefield. And, no, we healed you. You're fine. We healed you 2 days ago. Get up. But they start talking to him about, you know, you're essentially alone. You're continuing to serve as penance, you know, or such as it is. So we're sort of loners ourselves. You know, we're sort of ostracized. Jenny's alone because she made life choices. Vastra's alone because she's chosen to live in, you know, 19th century London, and doesn't really disguise who or what she is, which fascinates me. but they you know, kind of invite him along, and you know, you get that nice little stitch. But you know, he's you get to see that they appeal to him on a level that he's not accustomed to sharing. And again, it's just, I hope that they lock into that a little bit more as we know that they're going to be using the characters again for this upcoming series.
Yeah. Well, see, that's the kind of thing that I'm wondering is how much do you think that Stephen Moffat is kind of holding some of those stories back in case he gets to do a spinoff? Like, does he not want to tip the hand too much on these characters so that he can use it later to flesh out that show? Like, because, I mean,
it wouldn't surprise me.
We know that he said before that he's not planning on it, and he's far too busy with all this stuff going on and everything like that. But he's never denied the fact that he wants to do it.
Right.
See, I see the whole gang in kind of the same vein as Captain Jack, where, you know, he can come in and out of the story in Who, but his story could work really well on his own. Mm-hmm. So Moffat would want it to possibly be on its own at some point.
Mm. Yeah. And that's the kind of thing that I'm thinking too, is the fact that it's the characters do have such depth, and they are such great characters that you have to use them sparingly. Otherwise they wind up overshadowing the story that you're trying to tell.
Okay. But if you give them their own space,
yeah,
then let them work out their own tales, are they enough to carry on their own beyond a miniseries?
Right. And that's the question. Because, I mean, right now we've got, what, 4 episodes total with them. And then, you know, obviously some web stuff. Because, you know, after the stuff that we got, the Battle of Demons Run, 2 days later, we got Vastar Investigates, a Christmas prequel. And, you know, this was setting up the whole Sherlock Holmesian you know, work that the gang was going to be doing.
Right. They even like throw a line in there that says, you know, it's easy for us to believe that Mr. Doyle, the writer across town, has been using you as the basis for some of his character exploits.
Right.
So nice little snub there.
Yeah. And then the great detective that we see when the Paternoster gang is trying to get the doctor back into the swing of things and throwing all this different stuff at him, trying to see if anything sticks. And, you know, it's where we get our introduction to the Moon Knights and Strax's obsession.
Mm-hmm.
But then we get, you know, the snowmen, where we see the gang working kind of almost like his bodyguards or I guess caretakers almost.
Yeah, I don't know. You would describe that as a support structure, and I think that's legitimate because when he chooses to be involved in the goings on of the inexplicable or the what Scotland Yard can't handle on their own, and he decides to take the helm with it, they're absolutely there to be able to back him up, even though, you know, he may not do the same for them on their cases, so to speak. But you know, you've got Strax as his chauffeur at times, you know, which is a bit of a jump. So it's instead of just being partnered with Vastar and Jenny, so that shows that there's also Strax is also just as willing to go, you know, do as necessary at the doctor's behest. So that whole relationship just says to me that either he's considered to be, I mean, the locals describe them as 4. You know, and that fourth being the doctor, being this mysterious figure that no one really kind of knows much about. So I don't know. I think that for me said, okay, well, they're leaving breadcrumbs here that said that if they were going to start to do stories that involve them more, if they were going to stay within this time period specifically, I wasn't really foreseeing them, you know, pulling them out of time, using them in other settings and all. But anytime they were going to be tapping into, you know, this Victorian era, you know, we were going to get a little bit more exposure to them, and maybe they'll develop farther. Maybe they'll just be a, you know, quick touch in. Hey, remember these characters? You love them so much.
Right.
We bring them in every, right. you know, every six episodes or so. We pop one of them on screen to make the fans happy.
Yeah.
But, and, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I forgot what I was going to say there.
Well, you've been talking about, you know, do they have the enough to carry for a series? Well, go into the next time we see them. So go to the Crimson Horror.
Yes.
You know, and first of all, you know, don't spit on the floor.
But I want to know. So this one, one of the main things that I say about this episode that I do like is the fact that it proves that these guys can carry a story, not a series. I'm saying a story. Like, how long is it before we even run into the Doctor again? You know, this is up to Vastor and Jenny and Strax and just the three of them to carry this story forward. And then when we get the Doctor involved, it's almost like, oh, okay, well, he's here too. I guess he's going to be involved. And you know, you don't feel like, okay, you're not counting down the moments until we get the Doctor again.
Right.
You know, so it kind of proves that they are interesting enough characters to be able to carry a story. So whether or not, I mean, like I said, there's a lot of backstory that we don't have yet and a lot of information that Moffat can put in there to flesh out a lot of these stories and make them, you know, make them into something that we would want to watch. I don't know if it would be enough for more than just, you know, a mini series or maybe one series or something, but I think that there is enough there based on this episode. I think this is a good one to show people and be like, look, they can do this if you have someone behind it that understands.
Or maybe like an ongoing web series that had shorter episodes.
Yeah, I can watch little, possibly, yeah. You know, 7-minute, you know, mini adventures.
But I mean, I do like the fact that the story isn't reliant on the Doctor to, you know, to resolve it and to carry it. It's honestly, I think that I could have watched this whole story and seen them rescue the Doctor at the very end when they resolved the whole conflict and thought that it was just as entertaining. You know, it didn't feel like, okay, yes, I'm getting tired of these guys, put the Doctor in and have him do his awesome. You know, it was just as much fun watching these people.
I agree.
So then the next time that we run into him is the name of the Doctor. And this, I feel like this one really, really kind of cemented them in Who lore, as, you know, they understand, you know, they're people that the Doctor is willing to go to great lengths to assist and to help out. They are willing to do the exact same thing for him. And then, you know, they understand that they can work with Clara, who is the companion we're going to have.
Mm-hmm.
And they understand her, you know, quote unquote importance. I'm not sure that the viewers do, but apparently they do. So,
right.
Yeah, you know, it really does give them a foothold to play a stronger part in the future with Clara and with the new Doctor. And it really does like cement that spot where they can say, these are the people we're going to rely on to help carry us through the story.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. So that's going to be the best lead in we can have as to where are they headed now. Because if we've now gotten to the point where, you know, we don't necessarily know how much time since the gang became the gang,
mm-hmm.
you know, and since they were able to, you know, within that time period during Eleven's dark days when he's, you know, puttering around his ruffled top hat and whatnot and grumpy, how long from that point to you know, the point where we're on Trenzalore and such, and we go through all these things, that they've established this. This working friendship, relationship, partnership, business agreement at times. Now we've got this great unknown. They have not dealt with a regeneration.
Right.
So they're going to be just as unprepared as Clara is.
Well, but not necessarily, though. Because, I mean, like I said, we don't have a lot of backstory on Vastra. All we know is that she understands the Doctor. She's almost, you know, on par with the Doctor. He's someone that she's someone that he relies on. And we saw this in the snowman, when, you know, he went to Vastra and he's bouncing ideas off of her and they're having a strong conversation, not, you know, not him educating her on what's going on, but she's giving him just as much. So I believe that, you know, it wouldn't be beyond the realm of possibility for Moffat to say, this is something that the Doctor has explained to her at some point in the past. And she may not have witnessed one, but she understands and she knows the process that they have to go through. So you can very easily hand wave this and say she's going to be the one to help instruct Clara on how to take care of the Doctor.
Hmm. Or at least be there to provide factual information right. on it, if not, you know, the emotional stability.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's kind of the, I mean, it's a double-edged sword, but that's kind of the beauty of how Moffat has constructed these characters, in that he's left their past as a blank slate, and he's left a lot of what has happened before blank, so that he can go in and fill it in later as needed for whatever story he's writing.
Even though he planned it that way all along?
Well, yeah. He's had this thought out since series two, before he ever, you know.
Well, okay. Well, then there's just a couple of other things that sort of rattle around in my head. And I know we've discussed these in passing either, you know, on the cast before or before and after recording, or even just sitting across a table at one point. And that's things about what they've laid out so far with the characters that may or may not be working as far as their continued utilization. And going back and pulling through, you know, going over the transcripts of the full episodes that they were in for, you know, preparing for this, and going back and rewatching the little webisodes and things, one thing kind of stood out that I don't know whether this is you want to call this a positive or a negative. It could potentially controversial, or it could be nothing and just making more of it than it needs to be. But I just remarked on the fact that they were always utilizing the relationship between Vasra and Jenny as this driven nail. Like, they put so much emphasis on it every time they wanted to get some sort of a buzz on the, you know, with another character on screen, or if they were just doing it for the sake of trying to, you know, shake things up. But when is something just pushed a little too far for the sake of saying, "Ooh, look at us, we're edgy"?
That's the kind of thing that I was thinking, is there's a lot of times where they draw way too much attention to the fact that Vasra and Jenny are in a relationship. It's one of those things when you first come across it, you're like, oh wow, that's where they're going with this. Okay. And then once you see it that first time, you don't need to explain it anymore. Yes, you're going to have new viewers that come in, but it doesn't have to be pointed out every time. It's something that stands alone on, you know, it's like, okay, these two are together. And if you don't completely understand the depth of that, go back and watch a previous episode and you get it. It doesn't have to be hit every time, because then, you know, we're coming up on like the fifth occurrence of these people popping up. And it's like, if they make reference to the fact that they're married again, it's like, well, how many times do you need to say this in order for me to get it? Cause it's, you know, you wouldn't do this with a normal relationship or even, you know, even a regular lesbian relationship. It's not something that you point at and be like, look, we have lesbians. It's so because the fact that they're lesbians and she's a lizard, that makes it a special occasion. Treat it like a normal relationship, and it's going to go a lot farther than something you point at every time you need to, you know, make a point.
Do you think they're underestimating the audience? Is that part of the problem?
In terms of not giving the audience enough credit to just accept it?
They think that the audience is going to see, oh, they're a different species. They're both women. There's no way they're possibly in a relationship, and they're just going to miss it unless we hit them over the head with it.
That might be the case, but how many times is that pertinent information? I mean, like, they made the joke in the Vasra Investigates. You know, they brought it up to serve purpose as a joke, but like, how many times is that really important to what's going on screen?
One of the webisodes, they made that joke. I mean, you take it back to the 2 days after or 2 days later on the Battle of Demons Run, and they first convinced Strax to go along with them, and he looks at them and says, you know, aren't you both the women of your types? And they, you know, they acknowledge it, and they could have left it just there and just nodded and said, yep, that's true. And he said, don't you need a man one? And they said, no. Am I the man one? And they quit, you know, go back and make it a joke. And that's fine, but that's okay. Hit it once, hit the joke again. Hit it three times, now you're stretching it.
Yeah.
But do I need it every time a new character acknowledges the fact that the two of them are in a partnership? Does it matter? Or are married, actually? And then are we going to have to, you know, give some sort of an explanation as to, or does it even require an explanation? How could they possibly be married? You know, do they go forward in time or somewhere where these interspecies relationships are legalized and now they can go back and live out their life? Just move past.
Yeah. I think we definitely have hit the point where it's we've definitely hit saturation point, and they don't need to bring it up again. It's something that they've hit on often enough that we don't need it brought up. Like, even for new viewers, just let it stand, let it be what it is, and, you know, don't kill the people that have already been included in the story.
Well, speaking of that saturation point, then I'll point at the last remaining member of the gang there and say, have we beat the potato jokes to death? You know, have we essentially just taken the Centauran Empire and reduced them down to one-liners and sight gags?
We've got to have like some kind of like interchangeable facial part or something before it really reaches ultimate level, I think. But
yeah, I mean, because they're not all, yes, they are all clone batches, but they don't all have to be identical. Within their clone batch, they are identical.
Yeah.
But there are variations within the species. We haven't seen another Centauran, because when you go to the Day of the Doctor, you had two Strax clones piloting the invisible tank.
Yeah.
And again, they were just in it for a quick appearance, for a gag, and they're gone. They're not even a formidable enemy anymore.
Well, you know, the thing that I would like to see, and you can even keep Starkey, you know, keep Starkey playing the Centaurans. I don't care if every last one of them looks the exact same. Say that they adjusted the personalities on this next clone batch and have Strax explaining what's going on, like being the inside voice and fighting alongside the Doctor against these, you know, the regular Centaurans that are war hardened. And I don't think it's too late to save the Centaurans. I think it's too late to save Strax. But I don't think it's too late to save the Centaurans.
Yeah. So again, playing on that trope of the last of my kind. So Strax being the only Centauran that has learned some sort of a symbiosis with non-Centaurans. So when he have to go up against them, he has to choose sides.
Possibly. Yeah. I mean, you could take it any number of ways. It's just, you have to be careful with it and you have to let the potato jokes stay with Strax. That's his lot in life right now. I think we have to accept the fact that Strax is always going to be our Mr. Potato Head. But as long as you don't take it beyond him or beyond his clone batch, however you want to play it, I think it's okay. As long as we can establish that there are differences, then we should be okay with that.
Like, maybe we find out his batch just had a flaw in it.
It's a possibility.
They're the only ones like that.
Well, there was a fly in the ointment. And
got a whole clone full of bumblers.
Yeah. So it's, or, you know, like, hell, you could even throw it in, say, like, you know, the Doctor was there trying to stop this next clone batch from being created, and he dropped a yo-yo into it, and, you know, that's where Strax came from. Yeah, all kinds of things you can do with it to explain it away. It's just, it's going to take someone making the choice that we need to separate Strax from the rest of Centauran. So, but that leads us to the point of, where do we think that they're going to go with now? Like, where do we think that they're going to take the Paternoster Gang from this point moving forward?
My pull on it just seems to be kind of I keep going back to Pertwee and UNIT, that it's going to get down to more down to business. They'll have that respectful friendship that they know they've established. But on the, with the new personality type and the fact that he may be a little bit, you know, as they're advertising, potentially darker, questioning himself. Because we love it when the Doctor's questioning himself.
Yeah.
But that they're going to have to, one of the ways that they're going to have to be able to keep tabs on him and make sure that he's settling into this all right, because he is a danger to himself and others when he's unstable. And if they recognize that and they take it upon themselves to try to be a source of stability for him so that he is not such a risk, then one of the ways to do that is to keep him busy, so to speak.
Yeah. And honestly, that's something I was just thinking before you said that too, was I was wondering, calm down, Keir, please don't come at me yet. Do you think that Vastra is basically the modern day Brig? Do you think that she is filling that role of friend and confidant without being companion?
The only thing that's missing from that is that Vastra's not really working for any higher authority, other than the fact that she says that she's out to, you know, protect the Empire.
Right.
But that's not under any sort of official.
Well, yeah, I'm not saying it's a perfect analogy, but yeah.
But I see where you're going.
Filling a similar role.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I can walk with that.
Okay. So, I mean, and that's, I'm okay with that. You know, if they're taking, you know, similar, but, you know, distinctly separate, then you know, that was a great mechanic that they had back in the Third Doctor and Fourth Doctor and moving forward. And it gives them the ability to bring these characters back in when they're needed and send them away without explanation, without need for backstory or anything like that. It's just like, hey, look, we're both investigating the same thing. Let's work together again and move forward. End of story. Okay. Have a nice day. We're going our way. Yeah.
But don't step beyond the fact that we still do have that available relationship with Kate Lethbridge-Stewart.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, and that's the thing, is it seems like Vastra doesn't have time travel. So They're stuck in Victorian era. So we have modern day story. You work with UNIT and Kate. Victorian era, or sometime thereabout, you have the Patnosters.
Right.
Have they said how long-lived the Silurians are?
I don't think that it was ever actually given a definitive span, but I believe it's actually considerably longer than human.
I was going to say, I'm thinking like centuries, not millennia, but centuries. That seems right. I don't know. Please don't hate.
No, I'd have to go back and see from some of the mentions back in like the Sea Devils and some of those episodes where they start talking about the, you know, the evolution and the physiology of the Silurians.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, I like the fact that they're bringing them back. They weren't my favorites when they first came on, but they kind of they've found the niche for these guys. They've found the spot that they need to stick them in. And while not exactly handled correctly 100% of the time, I feel like they do serve a purpose and they are good. And I do like the characters. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy to see them returning. I'm slightly hesitant on how Moffat's going to handle them in the future, or whoever takes the characters or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I like the fact that they're coming back. I'm just hoping that they're treated carefully.
I have high hopes for how they're going to be able to utilize these characters with a new Doctor. Mm-hmm. I think that's really going to help us determine whether or not they shake out.
Yeah.
Because if they were just being meant as something that Matt Smith could leapfrog off of, then that's going to make itself readily apparent within their next appearance or two.
Very true. Very true. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, yeah, so we've got some news this week. quite a bit, actually. Imagine that. We take a week off and news happens. the first article that we've got here is apparently that Moffat doesn't know how to count and is blaming the rest of us for not knowing. Kier, you're the one that found this story. What is he saying now?
Well, it's you know, it goes back to the whole thing about, and we've discussed this a few times too. He's like, you know, bear in mind that the Doctors never refer to themselves by numbers. They don't. There's times when there's like little tips of things to you know, to play out their number, but they've really only been doing that since, you know, Tennant and Smith.
Right.
But anything prior to that, they had absolutely no need or no compelling urge to have to work in the fact that, oh, this, no, I remember him from centuries ago. I met him during my fourth self.
Right.
So it didn't happen that way. So pointing out the fact that, you know, if you're going to go on, the only touch point we have is that one reference where Smith's Doctor is talking about the fact that Tennant did the pump fake regeneration and kept the same face out of vanity. And he actually said number 10.
Right.
Was that a writing slip?
I think that was the fact. I think that was reality slipping in without someone really catching it. You know, I mean, we've all gotten used to it. The Third Doctor, Fourth Doctor, 10, 12, whatever it is, you know, they have numbers and that's their first name. You know, it's Phil Coulson's first name is Agent. That's how it is, you know. So it becomes such a habit that when you're referring to a specific doctor, you throw the number in there. And I think as a writer, Moffat just had that moment where he referenced this doctor and the only thing he could think to write was 10 and didn't stop and think, wait a minute, they're not supposed to say numbers. I don't think it was an intentional thing. I think it was just reality bled through and it happened.
Mm-hmm. He brought up an interesting point, though, as he was penning the 50th, and he, you know, decided to go back and take a look at some of the original BBC archive transcripts for the Five Doctors episode, and because he was, you know, dealing with the fact that he's going to have, you know, three Doctors on screen there, and they have to be written out as far as how do you label them as far as each line of dialogue goes in. And he said, you know, when you look at the five doctors, it didn't say, you know, first doctor, second doctor, third doctor. It said Hartnell doctor, Pertwee doctor, Troughton doctor, and so forth. So that's even within the mindset of the previous writers or previous generation of writers, they didn't take the numbering system into account at all because it just really doesn't apply. And now all bets are off. So what does it matter, really? Yeah. The regens are either reset or thrown out entirely. We're not really sure. The law of regen limits may not even apply at all. So do you just throw the whole numbering system out and go back to referring to them by the actor's representative name?
No, I think the thing that people need to understand is that we use the numbers to refer to the actors who have played the Doctor. It's not the regeneration number. That clearly is off at this point, even if we...
Right.
But we refer to, you know, Hartnell was the first person to play the Doctor. Tom Baker was the fourth person to play the Doctor. And so that's where the numbers come in. If you refer to them that way to refer to actors, then yes, it still applies. Obviously, that pertains to which iteration of the Doctor it was, but don't try and carry it over and say that, no, Tennant was the 10th iteration of the Doctor. We don't even know if William Hartnell was truly the first version of the Doctor. He could have had regenerations before that. You know, it's, I mean, obviously the time of the Doctor, you know, got things somewhat canonized or whatever, but you know, it's one of those things you really do have to say, okay, I'm referring to the actor who played that and his reign as the Doctor. So I'm saying 10.
I think that's slowly going to work itself out. I think it seems like, especially because of how everything got very muddy around the anniversary of the introduction of the War Doctor and so forth, and that screwing with the numbering system and so forth, and then how they decided to handle Smith's exit and getting the, you know, the divine touch of the finger from the Time Lords through the crack in reality, and all the way that they played out, you notice the media has not really been using 12th as a term that often. So even they are starting to play down. They're just referring to it as Capaldi's Doctor.
Yeah,
I think it's still a useful habit, though, because sometimes you want to refer to the character and sometimes the actor. And if a different actor is playing the same character, say someone else playing the first Doctor, it's useful to say the first Doctor as opposed to Hartnell's Doctor, because that's not necessarily the same thing.
Yeah, it's a valid point. I mean, we just have to remember that, you know, this is a meta concept. This
right, it's external, not internal.
Yeah, exactly. Of course, I'm sitting here looking at some of the comments that are on this story, though. And, you know, it's great. Yes, thank you, Moffat. We get it. You're a better fan than the rest of us. Moffat is turning out to be the Doctor's most ghastly villain. Is there not a Moffat-splaining tag? There should be a Moffat-splaining tag. I like that one. That is now the term for stories like this. It is all Moffat-splaining.
Yes, where you're actually getting no facts whatsoever.
Right.
But it is a nice little self-pat on the back for, aren't I clever?
Yeah. Right. So the next story that we get, and again, I label this one as Moffat's flaining. Apparently Peter Jackson is going to direct an episode, or might direct an episode. No, really. This time it's almost true.
It's kind of more like saying there's no reason why he shouldn't / couldn't.
Right. Maybe. But this is actually coming from, this was from Stephen Moffat, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was talking to FX, SFX, and obviously they've had conversation, this would certainly come up. I mean, between two, you know, creative juggernauts like that, they're going to discuss things, and of course, you know, a certain degree of crossover is going to happen because there's Sylvester McCoy walking around in the background saying, "Have you heard about this film I've been working on? This is lovely little thing down in New Zealand."
Right.
but yeah, I mean, take it from a business perspective. If you've got someone with that kind of clout that says, "Well, I'd certainly love to direct an episode," cash cow. The cash cow has just officially walked into the room and left a nice big plop on your desk. Accept it.
Right. I mean, this is very similar to, you know, saying, "Oh no, we're going to have Neil Gaiman write a script." It's, you know, it sounds great at first, and then you see the second Hobbit movie, and you're thinking, maybe not. I don't know. This is one of those things I'm like, if it happens, yes, I'm going to be excited and I'm going to wish for the best. But at this point, I'm tired of hearing about it already.
Yeah,
either do it or don't. Quit talking about it.
It's like Guillermo del Toro. It's like, oh no, we're going to do this great thing. And constantly talking. Anyway. So the next one that we've got, Deep Breath, the first episode of Series 8, will be showing in theaters and cinemas.
I don't know if this is going to really set a trend. I mean, we were having this discussion with some folks over the weekend here, and we're saying, you know, we're noticing that there's a considerable rise within about the past, what, year and a half, 2 years, of doing simul-screening, you know, large screen and television broadcast, and so that people can have a theatrical experience for what is normally a, you know, a TV format and such. But it's been, they've really been getting it down to a science, not only for pre-recorded materials like that, but just last weekend we caught in a local theater the live broadcast of the Monty Python reunion. So that was, I forget, 200 countries or something like that. And they, you know, had some audio quirks to work out because it was live, but nonetheless, you know, it just is becoming something that is increasingly available, and theaters are becoming more receptive to the idea of doing this sort of thing as a one day opportunity, you know, and open up a couple of the screens, especially if they can do it. Well, this is kind of the point I was coming around to, is if they do this and they decide that they are going to air it on on theatrical schedules at the same time it is on the UK broadcast schedule. So that means we'd be getting it here in the middle of a Saturday afternoon here in the States. Yeah. There's got to be, in my mind, there's got to be advantages to that on multiple folds, you know, keeping down on piracy. The theaters look at it as a way to just have this blowout matinee and they can go ahead and rerun it later in the day if they want to. Is this something they're going to do throughout the season and say, you know what, we've got a big pivotal episode coming up? Like, I know they're not doing a mid-season break, but they're probably going to have some sort of a, you know, a mid-season cliffhanger kind of thing. Are they going to start doing this more regularly?
Yeah, I was thinking about this, and it's going and seeing this one, the first one, it's a possibility, yeah. Am I going to go for every episode of that series? No, I'm not going to pay, you know, what, tickets are probably like $10. It's like, I'm not going to go and pay $130 for the season, you know, or for the series. I might go and spend the $10 to see this one. Or, you know, if, like you said, if there's a big one coming up that I want to be around a whole bunch of other Whovians enjoying it at the same time. Yeah, that's a possibility. But the, like you said, you know, it comes to that point of, if they're going to show it at the same time, if they're going to show it early in the afternoon and I get to sit in the theater and watch this 6 hours ahead of time, yeah, yeah, I'll probably do it. If they're going to show it at the same time that it's on my, you know, in my TV where I can sit on my couch with no pants.
Not put on pants?
Yeah, exactly. I'm sorry. I'm probably going to take my TV.
Yeah. You know, I can't see them doing it any more than for like premieres, finales, and maybe the specials.
Yeah.
Right. Because this isn't going to be running any longer. This premiere for this season, it's not like this is going to be any longer than the standard 40-some-odd minutes. Right, as far as we know? Deep Breath is only going to run standard episode length. So you're going to go out and shell for this to be in the theater for, well, a little under an hour.
Unless they're going to have like some special extra footage or something like they did for the 50th.
Yeah, but see, that's the thing, is it's constantly going to have to be different than the show that's on TV. They're going to have to add stuff or do it earlier or whatever the case is. It can't just be, hey, look, here it is. You know, we're going to turn the satellite in the theater onto BBC America, and there it is on the screen for you. That's not going to cut it. I mean, it is exciting. You know, we all went to see Day of the Doctor in the movies, and it was great, and it was a lovely experience, and I absolutely fell in love with it. But I'm not going to do that every single time if there's not a reason to. So that's where it falls, is what am I going to get out of this beyond the episode that I can, you know, sit on my couch and watch. But then some other news that we've got, apparently according to Peter Capaldi, there will be, quote, no flirting.
Right.
Yay.
Good.
Like, you're really concerned about that because it would have gotten a little creepy.
Well, yeah.
But yeah, it's nice to have that kind of assured that we, you know, we've got bigger things to pay attention to and more important things to expend our energy on than to put in, you know, unnecessary kind of, you know, flirty bits with these characters.
Yeah, well, and the way I was reading this, it made it seem like he was saying more like that his doctor is not going to be one to flirt with anyone, really. So it's not just Clara, but whoever comes after that will probably not get flirted with at all either.
Because because he's not going to get flirty, because this doctor is far more committed to his relationship to River. That's why he's wearing the ring now.
Right.
And other stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm still wondering how all that's going to play out, because I mean, we did get a passable exit for River in the time of the doctor, or the name of the doctor, and one of the doctor series. And Matt Smith has asked Stephen Moffat, don't give him Alex. That's his thing, is he felt like River was the 11th doctor's wife. And obviously it's up to Stephen Moffat to say yay or nay, but like that has been put out there. So I'm curious to see how this is going to play out. Are we going to get River again? If not, is it just because of Matt Smith, or, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah. Huh. Oh, but, for the record here, as we've been going through a lot of these articles and we're seeing a lot of things having to do with his particular discussion of things, I, for one, will not be referring to Mr. Capaldi as PCAPS ever.
Yes, I support that decision.
This is a thing? Wait a minute. What have I missed here?
Yeah. No, you get a lot of these, like the Mirror writers and things like that, that love, and I'll even blame the Nerdists, some of the Nerdist writers for doing this too. They love doing didn't this all start with like the Patterson thing from Twilight and whatnot? They started coming up with ridiculous initial based nicknames for, or basically I should just go back and just blame Sean Combs for P. Diddying and Puff Dippying and all that stuff. But no, PCAPS will not be making appearances on this show.
All right. Yeah, definitely unanimous decision there.
Yeah.
Oh, and then the 50th anniversary box set has become available for pre-order on the BBC shop. And I've got to say, I'm looking at this thing and I wants it. I needs it, my precious.
Okay, so what are the exclusive ads?
All right, so for £32, which breaks down to like $50-something, I think. I don't know. I'm not a math genius. You get the Name of the Doctor, the Night of the Doctor with the Eighth Doctor, obviously, the Day of the Doctor special, and then the Time of the Doctor.
Wait, there's more!
You also get An Adventure in Space and Time, the Five-ish Doctors reboot, Doctor Who : The Ultimate Guide, The Science of Doctor Who with Brian Cox, the Doctor Who Proms from 2013, the Last Day series of webisodes, the Day of the Doctor read-through, the Day of the Doctor cinema intros, so all that good stuff at the front when we saw it in the theaters that we couldn't find anywhere else, that's on here.
Screaming popcorn and
You get the deleted scenes and behind-the-scene videos from Name, Day, and Time. So there's a lot of stuff that they are cramming into this set.
Also, documentaries, Tales from the TARDIS and Farewell to Matt Smith.
Right. So, I mean, there's a lot that they are putting in. I would pay the $50 for just the three episodes, Name, Night, and Day, or Name, Day, and Time. And then you throw in The Adventure of Space and Time, which obviously, we all love that. We are all crazy about that. The Five-ish Doctors reboot. I mean, that thing is fantastic. And then you start throwing in some of the specials that they were airing in that same week. It's like, how is this really only £32?
Right. So you're dealing with, if for the DVD set, you're looking to spend $49 and change US dollars, step up to the Blu-ray and you're only spending about 55 ish, which, by box set standards for Blu-ray, not really unheard of at all.
It's about par for the course.
Yeah. But what is we're pre-ordering now. When are they saying that this is supposed to drop?
August 9th.
Okay.
So it's not that far away. It's not like you're paying for something and you're going to get it in 2016.
Right.
So I think this is definitely going on my list of, hey, you want something to get me? This one.
You've been racking your brains. And by the way, Jay and I do share the same birthday coming up towards the end of this year.
My birthday is earlier, so I should get mine first.
So Haley can watch it, and when she gets bored with it, she can send her copy to
it. Yeah, and then the last bit of news we get, and obviously this is a little bit delayed. We're sorry we took a week off, but the Series 8 trailer has come out, and we've gotten both the full, 60-plus seconds, and then the shortened version, which was, 35 seconds, but still had most of it except for the explosions. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of stuff. I mean, we've got a Tyrannosaurus in London. Yeah, it looks awesome.
We got our dinos. We've got a few new alien species to look at and a couple of somewhat familiar species appearances in there. We've got, obviously, a continued discussion of the am I a good man concept that seems like it's going to be the predominant theme for the first, at least foreseeable, few episodes of the season. If you want to take some of the splody bits and sparks coming from the control consoles and such, take that as you will. Mm-hmm. Did you guys happen to notice the little, I guess what they're calling the little listen bump trailer that released?
I did see that one too, which is basically you see the interior of the TARDIS and it pans up and then the doctor's sitting on top and his eyes pop open and he goes, listen, and then fade to black.
So, not really sure whether that's we're supposed to be listening to him as if he's about to, you know, explain something really important, or whether he's hearing something that he needs us to hear to hunt for Gallifrey, perhaps.
Well, the silence has fallen, so clearly there's stuff to be heard now.
Right, like those drums, those damn drums I keep.
What happened to the ducks? I need to know. So we are now within 4 weeks of seeing the first episode. It's definitely coming up. Next week, we are actually taking a listener request. We did get a voicemail and a shout out on Twitter asking us to do a podcast on the Weeping Angels.
It's good that we've got the suggestion, and we absolutely have to thank the listener base for tossing that out there as something to do, because it's always been something that I wanted to take further apart, because it's kind of a dodgy, kind of a gray area as far as a real understanding of this species and the implications and why they aren't a much more formidable thing for the entire universe to be dealing with. I mean, if they are just self-serving, why isn't everybody terrified of these fracking things? So,
because they haven't seen that episode yet.
Exactly. Blink doesn't translate into a lot of language.
So we will be taking an in-depth look at the Weeping Angels next week.
We'll be taking a look at them, and we will not be looking away. We'll just be looking straight at them for a week straight.
Right.
I got it. Certain species don't have eyelids, so they can't blink.
Well, they've got more than one sets of eyes, so they can just alternate the blinking.
Yes.
So if a silence is looking at a Weeping Angel and then moves around behind the Weeping Angel, does the Weeping Angel remember who they're supposed to attack?
Showdown.
This has been episode 96 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, I resent your implications of impropriety. We're married.
Scare saying, thank you for the opportunity. I look forward to obliterating you both in the name of the Centauran Empire.
And this is Haley saying, I'm the clever one, you're the potato one.
And we'll see you guys next week.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows by calling 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1477 to leave us a voicemail. You can head to GallifreyPublicRadio.com to leave comments on each episode. There you can also keep up to date on all the latest news and gossip, as well as what's going on in the community. Also make sure to head over to GunnaGeek.com to find out lots of other high-quality, geek-centric shows. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2014.
Jay's a little excited.
Sorry. I might have had a little bit too much Coke tonight. Coca-Cola. Clarify.
Wow. Good
night, everybody. Woo! No. That's getting cut out.
That kind of podcast.
My gums are so itchy.
Words taste like peaches.